In Washington today, the U.S. Supreme Court handed down a landmark decision. Despite the growing number of death row inmates who've been exonerated due to DNA evidence, the court reaffirmed the legality of the death penalty on the grounds that it is, quote, totally badass. For more on the case, we go live now to Onion News Network Washington correspondent Jane Carmichael. Hi, Jane.
Good to see you, Michael.
How did the Supreme Court come to their decision on this ruling?
Well, Michael, it began this morning when the lawyers for the petitioner presented to the court a videotaped lethal injection that showed an inmate writhing in pain before dying. As the tape played, Justice Kennedy said, quote, whoa. Justice Alito remarked, quote, holy shit. And Justice Ginsburg said, quote, that's wicked.
And what was the defense counsel's response to that?
Well, following the video, Chief Justice John Roberts said, while evidence presented to the court indicates a degree of fallibility in the procedural methods of capital punishment, it is the opinion of this court that the practice remains hella balls to the wall awesome. At that point, the decision seemed fairly certain.
Was there any dissent to the opinion by the Chief Justice?
Actually, very little. Justice Clarence Thomas supported the argument immediately, citing the precedent set by the movie 300, in which the offending parties were, quote, kicked into a huge pit. Justice Samuel Alito then stated, yeah, or like Judge Dredd. Justice Antonin Scalia then stated quite loudly, quote, I am the law.
That's the catchphrase from the film,
yes.
Judge Dredd.
Yes, yeah. It is. Then there followed approximately 1 minute of all of the justices individually claiming that they were the law.
The justices, I'm told, came down with a decision fairly quickly. Is that correct?
They certainly did. The court also took the rather unusual step today of submitting not just a written decision, but also drawings by all of the justices illustrating, quote, more badass punishments.
The final ruling was 8-1 in favor of the respondent. Tell us about the lone dissenting vote then.
Sure. That one came from Justice Anthony Kennedy. He stated that the death penalty is, in fact, too lenient a punishment and that sentencing inmates to life without parole seemed, quote, way more brutal because it's like they're on some sort of prison colony in the future where they just have to fight for the rest of their lives.
Some Supreme Court experts are saying that today's ruling is similar to the 2005 ruling in Torchinsky versus Peterson, that it is legal to carry a concealed weapon as long as the weapon is totally slick, like a huge-ass machine gun that you carry under a trench coat, like in The Matrix. Is that right?
Right, that's correct. Legal experts are already talking about how this clearly marks a trend towards the Roberts Court being less strictly constitutional and more strictly awesome.
Jane Carmichael reporting from the Supreme Court for us again. Thank you, Jane.
Thank you, Michael.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Injection, fellas.
I had a dream. I had a dream that I was in prison. I had a dream that I was in prison and I ran with a gang of poets. And all the other gangs were afraid to say our names, would do everything they could to maintain their distance, although resistance was futile. And they would kill each other and assault each other, but considered our truths too hostile. They didn't want us to take away the cartons of low self-esteem that society gave them, because that was all they had. And when they saw us walking down the block, they would dip in their cells. They'd rather dwell in that hell than face the heaven that we were speaking. They would rather see a fellow inmate's blood leaking than have us reach into their heart, even though all we ever said was that we loved them and wanted to save them, but every jewel we gave them just made them fear us more. And in the mess hall, they would rather gang war than sit at our table, even though we carved right in it that none of us were better and we were all up in this hell together. And what was most important is that we posed a united front in front of the COs and the warden. And although the poets might have known a little bit more about our oppression, we were all caught in the belly of the beast. But then I noticed that the ones who listened were the other poets and the ones who needed to hear us the least. So we started flying these kites called heat. And we told them each one teach one and each one reach one, because the place where we're from is the place where God lives. So they started a rumor that the poets had the mark of the Most High on our eyelids. And poets started buying into it and getting all egotistical and believing that they were better than the other convicts. So I took it for as long as I could, and then I stood in the middle of the cell block and I yelled out, whenever I write, I try to make sure that I give insight and vision. And I looked around and noticed that the ones who needed to hear me the most wouldn't listen. The ones who needed to hear me the most could not listen. It was like the ones who needed to hear me the most didn't listen. And that's when I woke up this morning and realized that I actually do live in that very prison.
This is the conspiratorial view of history, as opposed to the accidental view. And it is the conspiratorial view that we shall present in this program.
A devastating wall of water.
Had been inundated due to
7 meters high, sweeping in from the sea. The force and speed of the tsunami was so great that little could stand in its way. Buildings, cars, boats, and people simply swept away. The giant surge carried tons of debris in its path. Despite a tsunami warning, people were still caught out. Unknowingly, the drivers on this highway are heading towards the wave. It's so high, fast, and strong that it sweeps up over the elevated section and smashes into the oncoming traffic. The tsunami was triggered by Japan's most powerful earthquake. Magnitude 8.9, 6 miles underwater, and with the epicenter some 80 miles offshore. Still powerful enough to hit 1,300 miles of northeastern Japan's coastline. For a country used to dealing with earthquakes and tsunamis, there's nothing that can be done to stop the advance of the wave. Only mass evacuations could prevent catastrophic loss of life. This river throws boats and ships around as if they were small toys. And the wave becomes deadlier with the more debris it carries. Hundreds and hundreds of cars that will smash into anything that dares to stand in its way. Fires burned out of control, caused by gas explosions and electrical shortages. Power stations and nuclear reactors under threat. Millions of homes are now without power.
Take me down to the water side so I can see the wistful sky. Take me down to the waterside so I can feel the breeze blowing in. 'Cause there's something in the air out here that fills my swollen eyes with tears. I cough and splutter like a sad old man, slow consumption of who I am. And I'd pave the way to something great if I only had the will to concentrate. But for now I'll make a swift escape, a gentle ride to a gentle plane.
The quake struck mid-afternoon, when workers were still in their offices and children were still at school. This is Sendai Airport, north of Tokyo. Within minutes, its runway is submerged, and only the height of the airport buildings rescues the people inside.
Deputy Chief Cabinet Secretary Tetsuro Fukuyama.
A state of emergency has been declared. Shelter, medicine, food and water will be needed for the internally displaced and homeless. Japan's Prime Minister has pleaded with his countrymen to save the country.
So take me down to the waterside so I can see the tide coming in. To the waterside so I can be my one and only friend. 'Cause there's something in the way they laugh, pointed fingers and photographs, hidden agendas and cordial masks, take what they can get at every chance. And I'd love to join their special race, material things, superficial embrace, but I'm so overwhelmed with fear, feels like a time to disappear.
Just bring in these latest pictures for you, that to just give you a sense of this whirlpool that's been created there. I don't know if we can bring in Humphrey on this one. Is that usual? That because we've seen a wave moving forward, essentially, but that very much a spinning whirlpool-like motion.
Yes, I mean, without knowing the details of that, it's obviously hit something or some other force of current that has created it. And again, what we're seeing time and again with these pictures is the sheer force of how what looks like a placid Pacific Ocean, almost out of a tourist brochure, going along, and there's this incredible force. Then it hits the land, and it goes from seawater to sludge, and we saw it in the earlier pictures there, picking up houses, picking up trucks, picking up ships, and simply flinging them around as if they were toys. And here, I think, what you've got is some dreadful whirlpool, but it's a vortex that's sucking everything that it meets into itself.
So take me down to the waterside, so I can lift away the muggy veil. Take me down to the waterside, so I can wash away the self-betrayal. 'Cause there's so many people right round here, but no one ever seems to get that near. Judgment spin the minds of fools, scornful faces, ridicule. And I'd love to join with hands and hearts if I could only bring down half my guards. The cushioned life of an iconoclast wears me down so bloody fast. Oh, so take me down to the waterside, so I can see the wistful sky again. Take me down to the waterside, so I can be my one and only friend.
On March the 19th, the moon will swing around Earth more closely than it has in the past 18 years, lighting up the night sky from just 221,567 miles, 356,577 kilometers, away. On top of that, it will be full. And one astrologer believes it could inflict massive damage on the planet. Richard Knoll, a noted astrologer who runs the website astropro.com, has famously termed the upcoming full moon at lunar perigee, the closest approach during its orbit, an extreme supermoon. When the moon goes super extreme, Knoll says, chaos will ensue, huge storms, earthquakes, volcanoes and other natural disasters can be expected to wreak havoc on Earth.
These are the latest pictures from the Mars probe, NASA's most recent triumph in space. The Mercury Project, the Apollo missions, and the Mars probe. Now NASA embarks on its most daring and exciting project yet.
Thank you very much. We have an announcement to make. On July 4th of this year, America will blow up the moon.
We have the technology. The time is now. Science can wait no longer. Children are our future. America can, should, must, and will blow up the moon.
Yes, and we'll be doing it during a full moon, so we make sure we get it all.
Case of mistaken identity led to the wrong man being tasered at the Walden Galleria. According to the Buffalo News, Anthony Rose and Aja Brown fit the description of a pair of shoplifters last Friday. Police say both men resisted arrest and officers were forced to use their taser on Rose. The store manager then said they were not the culprits. However, both are now charged with resisting arrest.
Don't tase me, bro!
A revolution never comes with a warning.
A revolution never sends you an omen. A revolution just arrived like the morning. Ring the alarm, we come to wake up the snoring. They're telling you to never worry about the future. They're telling you to never worry about the torture. They're telling you that you will never see the horror. Spend it all today and we will bill you tomorrow. Three-piece suits and bank accounts in Bahamas. Wall Street crime will never send you to the slammer. Tell all the children in the arms of the mamas. The F-15 is a homicide bomber. TV commercial for a pop a pill culture. Drug companies circling like a vulture. Amaraki babies with the G.I. Joe father. 10 years from now, is anybody gonna bother you? Fire!
The rain. Turns out, not you. You're actually breaking the law if you try to capture rain falling onto your roof and pour it on your flower bed.
Revolution never comes with a warning. Revolution never sends you an omen. A revolution never comes with a warning. A revolution. Everyone addicted to the same nicotine. Everyone addicted to the same gasoline. Everyone addicted to a technicolor screen. Everybody trying to get their hands on the same green. From the banks of the river to the banks of the greedy. All of the riches taken back by the needy. We come from the country and we come from the city. Play us on a record, you can play us on a CD. All the shit you giving us is fertilizer. The seeds that you planted, you can never brutalize. Tell a corporation you can never globalize it. Like Peter Tosh said, legalize it. Girls and boys hear the bass and the treble. Rumble in the speakers and it make you wanna rebel. Throw your hands up, take it to another level. And you never, ever, ever make a deal with the devil. Yeah, fire.
This fascinating new study. They looked at almost 1,000 mummies and found that only a couple of them had any signs of tumors. And what that's leading them to suggest is that, in fact, that it's modern lifestyles and pollution that may be the cause of cancers.
Yep, you heard right. Cancer could be man-made. That's the conclusion from a controversial British study just released, which says cancer is a relatively new phenomenon caused by modernization. After testing hundreds of Egyptian mummies, the study concluded cancer was virtually non-existent in the ancient world. It led some scientists to suggest modern lifestyles were the cause for the disease.
But there's no doubt that the environment is responsible for most human cancers. Look around you now. Ask how many people that you know who are 30 or 40 have colon cancer or prostate cancer.
Never send you an omen. Revolution never come with a warning.
Space Shuttle Discovery now on final approach to the Kennedy Space Center. Just more than 30 seconds to go. Discovery's gear is down and locked. Main gear touchdown. The nose of the shuttle being rotated down toward the flight deck. The parachute being deployed. And nose gear touchdown and the end of a historic journey. And to the ship that has led the way time and time again, we say farewell, Discovery.
NASA's most traveled spaceship arrives home from the International Space Station, ending a 27-year flying career. It will now be prepared for display in a museum. America is stopping its costly shuttle program to free up funds for new spaceships that can travel to the moon, asteroids, and outside the orbit of the ISS.
Winning. I was banging 7 gram rocks. That's how I roll. Winning. I have one gear. Go. Epic. Winning.
Are you bipolar?
I'm by
winning.
Win there.
Win everywhere.
Winning. I'm a total freaking rock star from Mars.
Winning. Come on, bro.
I got talking blood.
Winning.
Bottle my brains and feel like, dude, can't handle it.
Win there.
Win everywhere.
Where?
If I could just say one thing, I've known Charlie for about 6.5 years. He's never drunk alcohol, used drugs in front of me. He's been completely clean for almost a decade until about 7 months ago. Now he's come off the drugs and the alcohol, which is almost like, you know, being off your meds. It has the same effect. So he's supercharged. He's angry. He's focused. And I know that when they interviewed him at his house, because I talked to him, they interviewed him for about 2 hours. And that's a little kind of joke that's out of context. He's tired of being judged and him being held up as... in this world. He didn't kill a million people in Iraq. He wasn't involved with the takedown of Building 7 here in New York.
And he thinks there's bigger devils out there than himself.
And Chuck Lorre's put out a whole bunch of these cue cards while having management tell him a month ago, if you speak out against 4 episodes being cut, we're going to fire you. Then he starts putting out all of these... Chuck Lorre. He starts putting out...
The producer.
He starts putting out vanity cards, not just on 2.5 Men, but on other shows saying Charlie Sheen is dead inside and soulless. You didn't show the worst one there, and so Charlie's told, we're tying your hands, now we're going to beat you up for whatever contract negotiations.
Let me ask you, so the question that I have is, so you're saying Chuck Lorre started this?
With the vanity card.
With the vanity card.
And up front had management, according to Charlie, and I've been there when he's on the phone with his management, or his manager comes over.
That's too fast for me, baby. Slow down.
Well, I know we don't have a lot of time. I'm getting on record.
Right.
They told him, before he said a word, they said, we're doing this, and if you criticize it, you're going to be fired. And he said, why are you telling me this? You know, I'm going through a hard time right now. But he didn't understand it then. I think they're trying to make him quit or something, so they have to pay out his contract or the $100 million in syndication. I think there's some shenanigans going on here. And then they start putting these things out. Then they start putting these vanity cards out, trying to prod him and push him.
Tell people what vanity cards are. I don't think people know.
Okay, most shows have a logo at the end, you know, like a little dog or the MGM lion. Chuck Lorre has these big write-ups at the end of his show. And imagine... at the end of the show with Charlie Sheen and other CBS shows.
This is on air,
saying this man is soulless. This man is dead inside.
Winning. I was banging 7 gram rocks. That's how I roll.
Winning.
I have one gear. Go. Epic.
Winning.
Are you bipolar?
I'm by
winning.
Win there.
Win everywhere.
Win. I'm a total freaking rock star from Mars.
Winning. Come on, bro.
I got talking blood.
Winning.
You bottle my brain and feel like, dude, can't handle it.
Win there.
Everywhere.
Let me ask you this. Do you think, because from that clip that we saw, a lot of people would ascertain, okay, or assume that Charlie was on drugs again. You say he wasn't. Do you think
he's taking blood tests?
Do you think he's...
I've been at his house when they come in, take the blood,
take
the urine.
I take your word.
I was there 2 weeks ago.
I hear you. Do you think he's manic depressive? I mean, as a friend, do you say, okay, this is something else? You guys are missing the boat. It's not the drugs. He's actually suffering from manic depressive disorder.
Let's just remember, Charlie's been a star. Charlie's been a star for 30 years, and all people know about is these episodes where he explodes. The Charlie Sheen I know is a compassionate guy who's really smart.
The episodes where he explodes. He was saying, this is the best thing that happened to the people who were with me. They're never going to regret it. They had
the
best time. You know, this is on drugs, tearing up rooms and hotels. What about that explosion?
I know this. I don't use illegal drugs, but when I quit smoking, I've had a long battle with that. I feel horrible for a week, and about a week later, my wife says, please, just go back to smoking sometimes because I get so manic. And I think we have a similar physiology. A lot of people have that physiology.
He was not giving it up at that point. He was on the drugs and booze.
Oh, you're talking about the last few months.
Do you think there's something underlying here that people are missing as a friend?
I just think that he's somebody going through a hard time who got clean, and that's why I went out to California to help him. Mm-hmm. And I know that it's wrong for them to be prodding him, yes, and demonizing him and trying to make him blow up. That's actually what I believe is going on here. They should all just shake hands, bury the hatchet, come together for the crew of 2.5 men. I want try to support Charlie, but also Chuck Lorre, everybody else, but understand what happened.
Okay. So you're worried about him.
But Charlie's tired of being held up like the devil. We got the TSA putting their hand down people's pants. Infowars.com covers it all. Okay. We've got the banks bankrupting the U.S.
Wait. Let's stick with Charlie, because that's way too much for me.
No, Charlie is mad because he's held up as all the problems.
That.
He didn't steal $23.7 trillion.
But we're just here to figure out what is happening with Charlie. That's what we're trying to figure out.
And he's doing interviews now, so he has a chance to speak for himself. And
but they're taken out of context.
We're not comparing him to Gaddafi.
Oh, they've been comparing him to Gaddafi.
Look, I was just saying, I don't think I've
Let's compare George Bush, $1 million Iraqis, to Gaddafi.
Are we really going there right now?
Torture, secret arrest, America turning into a police state.
I was banging 7 gram rocks, that's how I roll.
Winning, I had one gear, go, epic.
Winning,
are you bipolar?
I'm bi.
Winning,
win there,
win everywhere.
I'm a total freaking rock star from Mars.
Winning, come on bro,
I got taco blood.
Winning,
you borrow my brain and feel like, dude, can't handle it.
Win there,
win everywhere,
where.
It is said when you see someone who looks like they don't feel very well, you say, my goodness, you look like death eating a cracker. Or if they look really bad, you say, you look like death eating a cracker walking backwards.
These are some of the faces of the Wisconsin protests. Mothers, teachers, and students. But according to Fox News, the people protesting...
And I'm sure I'll get a flurry of emails calling for me to apologize for naming them thugs and bullies, but they are, and I won't apologize for it, but that's what they are.
In reality, there was no bullying going on. That was certainly the case when RT was on the ground in February as the protests were peaking.
Even though people who oppose these demonstrations have been saying that what has been going on here in Madison has been chaotic rioting, it is actually not the case, with music playing and people really celebrating their right for freedom of speech, democracy, and their rights as workers.
That has remained the case for those who have closely followed events.
I know for a fact that there has been no violence whatsoever in Wisconsin. I mean, aside from people stepping on each other's toes accidentally, there just hasn't been.
Police even issued a thank you statement to protesters for being peaceful. But according to Fox News Channel, the demonstrators have been an uncontrollable mob.
Not a terribly civil or classy group of people. Profanity, vulgarity, and pretty vile behavior. These are nothing but thugs and bullies.
The non-existent violence was taken to an extreme with a spin of an alleged attack on a Fox reporter.
That guy just hit me, so they just let you know.
Who seemed to have seen it coming.
The hate that you get from these demonstrators, you can see it in their faces.
The utter lack of civility and the harassment of reporters there.
From a video posted online, it became clear that nothing close to harassment had taken place. But it was too late to stop the infamous Fox spin.
They're pushing him. They're shoving him. Apparently one even hit him.
Pushing it even further, the so-called bullies came out to protest in a cold, snowy winter. A more violent protest video featured by Bill O'Reilly had palm trees in the background, turning the channel into a cartoon show.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was suggesting today and yesterday
and the day before that NATO might consider military intervention in Libya, and some of our NATO allies, notably France and England, have suggested that. Governor Palin, do we have any business introducing the American military into yet a third Muslim country in the Middle East? Stated differently, should we side with the rebels and introduce American military force in this civil war in Libya?
You know, I can really respect the position of the laissez-faire type attitude when it comes to intervening in yet another country and their business and who their leader is going to be. But when it comes to Gaddafi, when it comes to the situation in Libya, I have a little different sense there, because Gaddafi is a madman and he sanctioned the killing of innocent Americans. And we have an opportunity to help with allies, we would hope, to oust Gaddafi or to let his people oust him. And if we can exert that constructive pressure that we've heard the White House talk about, even though they give a lot of lip service, they don't actually seem to want to put action behind that, via perhaps a no-fly zone, even though that could end up to be an expensive proposition, as it was in Iraq, costing $1.3 billion a year to enforce a no-fly zone there. I would support some action taken to punish Gaddafi, because I do think that as a leader of the free world, it is President Obama's job to exert that pressure to contain the evil and restrain it in order for innocent Americans to, and our interests to be protected.
And it's a trail of bones from Africa all the way to America. All the islands, all the way to New Zealand, so numerous that Christ can literally walk on the damn waters, on the bones. It's ridiculous. And it has to stop. You know, it's economic exploitation and false inflation. They divided the people with their segregation. Put them on one big plantation, graduate from school, no cause for celebration, and we must inspire the next generation. Unequal distribution of the wealth. People are tired, and they are waking up all over the world. And we have interest in all these countries. No, hell no, we do not need to be in Libya. World War One was over Libya. Over that damn jet fuel. Like I said, they don't need to be over there, period. Tear down these walls. Tear down these walls. These walls were installed because these people were fascists like Hitler and Mussolini, social Darwinists, eugenists. Do you hear me? That will eradicate people, human beings, from the face of the earth. Just the total opposite of a humanitarian. You know what I'm saying? Just straight skull and bones. Play Dungeons and Dragons with your ass. Do you hear me? For some fat bitch's sweet tooth. Hey, man, these people are insane. And that's what it's all about, man, you know? Like I say, it's all about insanity, man. And at some time, man, it's going to have to stop. Man, you know what I'm saying? Really, you know, it's going to have to stop. And so, dude, I'm just going to conjure, you know, it all into existence, dude. You feel what I'm saying?
We're constantly told that we live in a capitalist society. But what does capitalism mean? The word comes from the Latin capitalis, meaning of the head, and the relation of this concept to the later financial connotation of the word capital is unclear. Its first use in that sense was actually the word capitale, meaning stock or property. The basic building unit of capitalism is the corporation, and these first started in the 1600s. The development of the corporation was spurred on by the improvement of sailing and navigation technology and the ensuing boom of the shipping industry. That's why the root word mare, meaning sea, is at the heart of the word mercantile, and why we still say shipping when we are referring to the transport of goods, no matter the method. The improvement of seafaring led to the blossoming of a new form of economy. Now merchants could sail to India, Asia, Africa, or even the Americas, and trade an unprecedented variety of goods. But ships and crew were still expensive, and the voyages dangerous. If one trip went bad, an investor could find himself in debt for life, and worse, in debtor's prison. So the government of Holland, a leading power amongst the sea merchants of Europe, came up with a novel concept by which numerous merchants could pool their resources and minimize their individual investment risk. They created a corporation, a group of investors who would collectively invest in a business venture to form a company, which then became a legal person, according to a declaration in the company's charter granted by the government. This person was then able to enter into legal contracts and business ventures, just like a regular person. But there was one important difference. Unlike a real person, the corporation could not be thrown into debtor's prison. Indeed, there was and still is no real way to force a corporation to pay its debts. When the corporation determines that it is no longer viable, it declares bankruptcy and, more often than not, leaves those to whom it owes money holding the bag. This arrangement worked out well for the Dutch merchants of the 17th century, and soon the idea was picked up by other countries, like Britain. Thus, the formation of the famous British East India Company, rival to the Dutch East India Company, was possible. In a corporation, the total worth of the company is divided into shares, which are sold to the investors as percentages of the company's worth, slices of the pie. The more shares each investor owns, the greater his slice of the pie. The price, or value, of each share fluctuates along with the overall value of the company. Dividends from the company's profits are paid to the investors annually in relation to the number of shares that they own. At any time, an investor may sell his shares to another investor. It did not take the Dutch merchants long to realize that these shares of a corporation could be traded almost as a form of currency. This led to the creation of the first stock exchange in Holland in the year 1631, a year after kapitaal began being used as a financial term. It is interesting to note that there is actually a connection between modern notions of, quote, freedom, representative government, and corporations. In feudal times, everyone was the subject of the monarch, and most people lived as serfs on land owned by noble families. The word serf is related to servitude, and implied exactly that. Only the royals and nobles, who ruled their own lands, had any sovereignty. Nobody else had any rights, autonomy, or control over their own affairs. It wasn't until trade expanded in the Renaissance that the merchant class arose to challenge the aristocracy, because they had money to buy their own land. Then they were no longer serfs, but, quote, freemen. The city of London is a prime example of this connection. Few people in America know that London is a much larger metropolis than the 1 mile square area that technically constitutes the, quote, City of London Corporation from whence it originated. This had been a Saxon merchant city before the island was conquered by the Romans in 43 AD and had been ruled by an ealdorman, or underking. When the Normans took over, William the Conqueror promised to respect the city's sovereignty and basically built his kingdom around London in cooperation with it, but not subduing it. Because of this, London became known as the Sovereign City and is headed by its own Lord Mayor to this very day. The traditional government of London has always been representational, and the voting power came from its, quote, freemen, the members of the livery companies that are at the heart of its foundation. These were the trade guilds, such as the scriveners, the longbow makers, the master mariners, the parish clerks, etc., and they usually had names starting with the word worshipful company of. The word livery is related to the Latin liberare, meaning to liberate. You see, originally, the word freedom implied that one had, either by apprenticeship, or by payment, or by blood inheritance, been emancipated from serfdom by practicing a trade. It meant that you were free to form your own contracts and conduct your own business in the city of London, and in order to gain your freedom, you had to belong to one of the city's companies. You were granted the, quote, freedom of the city when you took the, quote, declaration of a freeman, which is a ceremony that qualified applicants can still partake in today. These livery companies each had their own authority derived from their members, and these combined to form the corporation of the city government, deriving its sovereignty from its freemen. This concept of freedom is, of course, at the heart of the word Freemason, an institution at least partially derived from the Mason Guilds of England. Later on, in the American colonies, freemen were those colonists who had paid for their immigration fees through indentured servitude, usually 7 years, and were now free from debt or other legal restraint. In London, a symbiotic relationship formed between the city corporation and the Crown of England. Indeed, to this day, the monarch observes the custom of obtaining permission from the Lord Mayor before entering the 1 mile square city. The city became the prime influence on English politics and gained a reputation as the maker of kings. The city would always support the crown as long as the support was mutual. If not, the city would make sure that someone more cooperative took over. a book called London Forever, The Sovereign City, by Colonel Robert Blackham, published in the early 1930s, explains it well. The city was, indeed, always loyal to the crown when loyalty was possible, but its citizens have never hesitated to oppose the king when they considered that their rights were imperiled. London stood for liberty and moderation and was the champion of constitutional rights regardless of the nature of the oppressor. When the king ceased to respect the laws of the land and the interests of his people, the sovereign city drove him from the throne. When the Commonwealth ceased to represent popular government and tried to rule by force of arms, the secession of the city brought back the exiled dynasty. By its action, the sovereign city expressed the national dislike for republican government and England's firm belief in constitutional monarchy as the best form of government for a free people. The Lord Mayor of the city was largely responsible for forcing the Crown of England to respect the rights of its subjects through the Magna Carta. This document was the basis of English common law, upon which the law of the American colonies was founded, in which male property owners were granted the rights of freemen. The American Constitution and the Declaration of Independence were grounded in common law. But here in America, after the Revolution, came a truly revolutionary idea, influenced by the City of London Corporation, that a government could be formed to exercise the inherent sovereignty of freemen and not just that of a monarch. The drafters of the Constitution recognized that we the people had formed the state governments to exercise our sovereignty, and thus the states became sovereign entities themselves. Those states then united to form a confederation on behalf of the sovereign people. Interestingly, the colonization of the New World by Britain was done through corporations such as the Virginia Company. It was from London's docks on the Thames that the ships departed. It was they who were ultimately in charge of the first colonial governments. And although we fought a war to remove the influence of England's crown upon the American government, some question whether we ever truly broke away from the influence of British corporations. Indeed, the design of the American flag essentially stems from that which flew on the merchant ships of the British East India Company, which featured the same stripes with the Union Jack as the standard in the upper left corner instead of the stars that later replaced it. In a way, this is altogether fitting, since it was through corporations and commerce that men in the New World had gained their freedom in the first place. But the Constitution, Bill of Rights, and Declaration of Independence indicate that this freedom is really inherent and, quote, self-evident in, quote, all men, not just something granted if you happen to have enough money to buy property. The Founding Fathers were influenced by Freemasonry, natural philosophy, and the belief in these natural rights. For religious people, the concept can be traced back to the previously mentioned dominion over the earth granted to Adam by God. This is what gives a man the right to form a contract with whomever he chooses, including spirits, and that's what makes him free. But something malodorous has occurred over the years since the American Republic was founded. Through a gradual process, the loose confederation of sovereign states became united into a national government. Originally, according to author John David Van Hove in his book The Global Sovereign's Handbook, the corporation called the District of Columbia controlled only the city of Washington, D.C. and the American territories, but not the sovereign states. There was a government located in D.C., but it was merely exercising the power of the states through donation, which could be revoked at any time. Yet over the years, and especially after the Civil War, it took on the character of a national government and asserted authority over the states. The 14th Amendment to the Constitution, which is thought to be responsible for freeing the black slaves in the South, actually had a much more sinister purpose. It defined the residents of the states as, quote, citizens of the national corporation located in Washington, D.C. As Van Hove put it recently on this program, it actually, quote, made slaves of us all. By signing this amendment, states were not only forfeiting their own sovereignty, but that of the individuals within them.
Once upon a time, there were 100 million people. They had different interests, different beliefs, different occupations, but for the most part, they got along pretty well. Then one day, a gang of a few hundred people showed up. Need to zoom in some more to see them. I know they're there somewhere. Zoom in. There they are. And this gang of a few hundred said to the throng of 100 million, "From now on, you all have to give us a cut of everything you earn."
This is an accurate graphical comparison between the number of American taxpayers and the number of U.S. congressmen.
And the throng said, "Gosh, do we have to give you a cut of what we earn?" And the gang of a few hundred said, "Yes, you have to." And the throng said, "Well, okay, I guess we have to." And one little troublemaker asked, "What if we don't?" The gang of a few hundred didn't like this, and said, "If you do not comply, we shall unleash upon you our legions of enforcers." And the throng cried, "Oh no, please don't. We will comply, we will pay."
This is an accurate graphical comparison between the number of American taxpayers and the total number of IRS employees.
Time went by, and the gang of a few hundred said, "Now we want more of what you earn." And this kept happening over and over again, until eventually some of the throng were paying almost half of what they earned to the gang. Whenever the gang demanded more, the throng would say, "Golly, we're already having a tough time. Do we really need to give you even more?" And the gang always said, "Yes, you must, or we shall unleash our legion of enforcers." Now the gang of a few hundred was getting trillions of dollars every year, spending it on wars and pyramid schemes, giving away goodies to their friends, buying influence, and doing lots of other things. And some of the throngs started saying, "We don't really like the war you're waging with the money we give you. Do we really have to be paying for that?" And the gang said, "Yes, we demand it. Don't make us send out our legion of enforcers." And some of the throng said, "You're taking our money and giving it to huge corporations and giant banks, and some people who just don't want to work. A lot of these things we don't like." And the gang said, "We don't care. We will decide how to spend it. You just do as you're told, or else." And the throng said, "Okay, I guess we have to." But eventually the throng got so fed up, so angry, that they took a drastic step. One day they said to the gang, "We don't like what you're doing. We want a new gang." And after pouring a huge amount of time and money into the effort, they replaced the gang with a new gang. Then the throng pleaded with the new gang, "Now, at long last, can we keep our own money, or at least keep more of it?" And the new gang said, "Sorry, but after much discussion, we've decided that you can't. You have to keep giving us what you've been giving, in fact, a little bit more than before." The throng was distraught and said, "This is dreadful. But after all, what choice do we have? I mean, they say we must comply, and they have that scary legion of enforcers. We're powerless against them. We'd better just do as we're told." So they did as they were told, got poorer and poorer, and lived miserably ever after. But after all, what else could they have done? What power could this throng possibly have compared to this gang of a few hundred and their enforcers? What chance would this thing have against this thing? How could these 100 million people ever hope to successfully resist the awesome power of this tiny little dot? In case anyone missed this, let's review. Here's them. Here are their enforcers. Here's us. Them. Us. Them. Us. Does anything about this seem just a little strange to you? Are you perhaps wondering, why does the throng need the permission of the dot to do anything? Why do these people feel the need to ask this tiny little dot if they can keep more of what they earn? Why would they spend year after year literally begging for lower taxes from this little dot? Is this dot just really darn intimidating? Is it very persuasive in its reasoning? To be blunt, why would this throng give a rodent's backside what this tiny little dot wanted? The fact that this tiny dot has the gall to issue such demands to such a throng is pretty startling in and of itself. But what is far more amazing is that the throng obeys this minuscule little parasitic gang of control freaks. We'll be right back.
Magdalena isn't a normal tortoise. She has two heads and five legs. She was born in Žilina in Slovakia, and now she's set for stardom. Magdalena's going to be predicting the outcomes of ice hockey matches, but that doesn't mean life with two brains and an extra leg is a walk in the park, as her owner explains.
The fifth leg between the two heads simply doesn't know what to do with itself, and the second head sometimes doesn't allow the tortoise to know where to go.
It is lucky that Magdalena is a pet tortoise, though. In the wild, she wouldn't survive, because all the other tortoises would shun her. Challenges conventional wisdom. Empathy was long thought to be a defining human trait, but now scientists think chickens might be able to feel the pain of others too. It's all come out of a study that saw scientists ruffling the feathers of chicks and seeing how their mothers responded. It turns out that the hens became increasingly distressed and began to mirror the reaction of their chicks.
For 6 years, Edward was a loyal guide dog helping Graham wasp around Stowmarket. That was until he developed severe glaucoma and had to have both eyes removed.
It was horrific, and he actually, as we shut the bay where he was staying at the vets, he actually just sat there, and Sandra said he was just shaking and trembling, and it was so upsetting. And I was in floods of tears, and I am now nearly.
And for Mr. Wasp, having to get a replacement was just as painful.
But I did feel as if I was betraying Edward in the sense I knew I'd still love him and give him all the time I could. But it's a difficult thing when you start to go out and you haven't got the dog you've loved for the last 6.5 years.
But now Opal is part of the family and not only helps out her owner, but her predecessor as well.
The new dog, as long as they got on together, would be company for Edward, and I hope that would help him. And in the way I think it has. So over the few months, they've become great friends, and it's good company.
Do you like being a participant in the watering can of the flowers of freedom throughout the world?
We can understand that we're all part of this incredible matrix of vortices and life and energy, and when you have that, then when you see that, you're no longer afraid of dying, which has a great consequence, because then you're no longer afraid of living. And when you're no longer afraid of living, then no one can tell you what to do. And so when I made Infinity the Ultimate Trip, I had a twofold reason for making the film. The first was for people to show to people that are on their way to passing over, or for people who are interested in what happens when they pass over. And then the second reason, which is a more subversive reason, is to try to make people understand that there's nothing to fear, that the only thing to fear in this world is death. And when you know there is no death, then you know there's nothing to fear. And when we finally come to grips with this idea that there's nothing to fear, then the elites and the people that rule this world are going to be bereft of ways to push us into doing what they want. And so I'm a big fan these days of the word no, and I think that we need to start saying no to them and mean it. And we need to say, no, we're not going to send our children to fight in your wars, and no, we're not going to eat your toxic food, and no, we don't want your toxic air and your oil spills and all of that. And when we reach that point where we just take a Gandhi-like stance and say, nope, we're done with all of that, and we begin building a parallel society, you know, right next to this society, one that's built on these higher dimensional understandings, then we can, at that point, be free of the rule of whatever they are, the reptiles, the Aryans, the elite, the whatever you want to call them. And so that's really the main reason. I think this is the big fight that we've all been wondering about since the 60s. I think that the big fight is now on now. And we can, if we go head-to-head against these guys, they're going to cream us. So we have to be smart here, and we have to understand that we can't fight them head-to-head. We have to fight them in subtle ways. We have to do the unexpected. And so using their own weapons against them is something I'm in deep favor of. So I make movies using their equipment that they invented. And, you know, you do a radio show using the equipment and the internet that they invented. And I think that's the best way to do it, to use their own power and strength against them. I call it Aikido-ing the moment. In every moment, you have to Aikido the forces that are trying to destroy this world. And I think that this, now we've now, since 2010 began, I think we are now finally in the big fight, in the big struggle, and I think we're going to win.
Now go find the others.com.
Yeah, man, I'll tell you what, that dang old internet, man, you just go on there and point and click 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 click, it's real easy, man.